Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. I'm today joined by Bassam Fatou, who's director of the OIS, and we're here today to discuss the key messages from his recent energy insight, Transitioning to Net Zero, CCUS, and the Role of Oil and Gas Producing Countries, that he co-authored with Wolf Heidug, who's visiting research fellow at the OIS, and Paul Zakour, who's founding director of Carbon Counts. And the paper was published by the Institute in June 2021. Now, just to timestamp this podcast, we're recording it on the morning of Friday, the 7th of September, 2021. Bassam, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Thanks, David. It's nice to be back.
Well, look, Bassam, can we start perhaps with a broad question to put the paper into some context? You know, why does your paper focus on oil and gas exporters?
I think a key feature of climate change, not always appreciated enough, is the unevenness of its impacts on countries and regions. This is not only in terms of the physical impacts of climate change, but also in terms of the economic adjustments needed to reduce emissions and achieve climate targets. Some countries, particularly those that rely heavily on the hydrocarbon sector as the main source of their income and export revenues, will have to undergo much deeper adjustments and transformations. This unevenness also applies to the capability to undertake these transformations. This applies even within the group of oil and gas exporters, where some are in a better position to cope with the challenges of reducing emissions and investing in low carbon technologies. Also, climate policies can cause substantial distributional effects and allocation of wealth. Oil and gas exporting countries are expected to experience a decline in their incomes and wealth as the demand for their key export product is projected to fall. So there is this dimension, David. But I also think that oil and gas exporters can play an important role in being part of the solution to climate change and should be incentivized to play an active role. Some key oil and gas exporters recognize the climate change challenge and have shown willingness to employ their technical and financial resources to tackle that challenge. I believe this trend should be recognized and encouraged in climate change negotiations.
Okay, so in a world transitioning to zero emissions, you know, what options do oil and gas exporters have to confront some of the adverse effects?
One option would be to diversify away from the hydrocarbon sector. But David, as we have discussed in previous podcasts, there are limitations to this strategy. Most oil and gas producing countries face real challenges in realizing meaningful diversification, particularly fiscal diversification that is needed to reduce the reliance of their government budgets on hydrocarbon revenues. Also, diversification into different areas away from their competitive advantage runs the risk of failure of establishing viable non-resource export sectors. Achieving diversification also requires extensive structural reforms to improve the economic and business environment, building human capital, as well as removing barriers to private sector participation. And it's not clear how fast or even whether such extensive economic and social reforms can be implemented by most oil and gas exporters. And despite decades of trying to diversify their income sources, the track record has generally been poor, and most oil and gas exporters find themselves confronting the challenge of the transition from a weak position. But there are also other reasons as well. After all, the oil and gas sector still enjoys higher margins than any new industries or sectors that governments are aiming to diversify into. Governments can also leverage oil and gas revenues to ease the pain of structural reforms. Also, David, given the speed of the transition is highly uncertain and its impacts are uneven across the globe, exiting too early from such an established strategic sector deprives these countries of an important source of income and a source of competitive advantage.
But if diversification has its limits, Now, what other policies do you think these countries can pursue then?
Some countries, particularly those in the Gulf, can compete effectively on cost. Their cost of extraction and development of hydrocarbons is the lowest in the world. Also in the face of uncertainty about demand and in response to oil substitution policies being implemented by oil importing countries, some exporters could decide to adopt faster extraction and monetization strategies. But again, David, the lack of fiscal diversification and the high social costs of production act as a constraint on this strategy. Increasing supply in the face of slowing demand could result in lower revenues, at least in the short term. In the medium to the long term, rapid monetization, high output policy, and lower prices could result in production losses in high cost and less stable areas, and some producers could increase their market share, partially compensating for the lower prices. But this is not the only consideration. In response to faster monetization, oil importers may decide to implement carbon taxes and capture a substantial part of the rent. And this is nothing new. Importing countries, especially in Europe and Japan, have always taxed fossil fuels heavily. Although this was not motivated necessarily by environmental considerations, the underlying motivations make no difference in terms of importing countries capturing substantial part of the rent.
But a solution could always be to, I imagine, diversify into energy-intensive industries. But do you think that's a realistic alternative?
Well, yes. Oil and gas exporters can diversify into sectors where energy is an important component of competitiveness, like petrochemicals, steel, cements, fertilizer. And this is already happening. This could create a range of higher value-added products. It could also provide a hedge against price and demand volatility, and if implemented properly, could lead to the development of services and tradable sectors. But again, David, this strategy is also not without risks. Industrialization into energy-intensive industries increases domestic emission of greenhouse gases, and some importers, such as the European Union, are already developing policies to measure and verify the carbon content of some final goods, and actually have plans to implement carbon border adjustment measures. That's why in the paper we make the point that in addition to competing on cost, hydrocarbon-rich countries should also compete on reducing their CO2 emissions, and this is where CCUS could play a central role in their development strategies. I believe competing on reducing emissions is key to increasing the resilience of their strategic energy sector in a world where policies to reduce emissions are being implemented at an increasing rate.
Which, of course, brings us on to the next question, which logical question I have to say, Balsam, is, you know, how can these countries actually succeed in reducing these emissions then?
Well, the most obvious strategy is to invest in renewables, solar and wind, which in addition to energy efficiency programs and reforming energy prices, these countries can optimize the energy mix and reduce CO2 emissions. And this could even lead to the creation of new sectors. And many oil and gas exporters have great potential for renewable energies, and they should accelerate investments in renewable energy. But the margins in renewables cannot fully substitute for the rents generated by the hydrocarbon sector. So exporters should work towards ensuring that their production processes and core hydrocarbon products can also compete on the emissions front. And this is where CCUS can really play a key role.
Okay, so what is special about carbon capture, usage and storage, CCUS? You know, what competitive advantage would these countries have in CCUS?
I think there are two dimensions to this question. One dimension is related to global climate action. Deployment of CCS is needed to help achieve the goal of net zero emissions, given that oil and gas are projected to remain part of the energy mix, at least for the foreseeable future. For some energy-intensive, hard-to-abate sectors, such as steel, and cement, technical options to reduce emissions without CCS are currently very limited. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2018 showed that most scenarios assume significant CCS. Otherwise, it would not be possible to limit the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. CCS could also reduce the cost of meeting climate targets. So there is this global dimension. The other dimension is related to oil and gas exporters. CCUS is a climate mitigation action through which some oil and gas exporters could establish a competitive advantage, given their natural resources, for instance, their geological storage capacities, their access to depleted hydrocarbon reservoirs, and their existing infrastructure. But also in terms of technical resources, for example, their expertise in subsurface technology. So the deployment of CCUS could provide them with an opportunity to contribute to climate change action, but also to continue to monetize their reserves in a more sustainable way and retain the competitiveness of their oil and gas sector and energy-intensive industries in a carbon-constrained world.
Okay, so if CCUS is essential to achieve climate targets, I assume that we would see more investment in CCUS and we would see more CCUS projects being planned in oil and gas exporting countries, those that are certainly not highly diversified. But my question is this currently the case, Bassam?
You're right, David. CCUS potential has not lived up to expectations, and CCUS role in mitigating climate change remains very limited so far. A recent IEA report identified around 20 large commercial CCS facilities with capacity to capture only between 40 to 50 million tons of CO2 each year. And actually, most of these projects are located in developed economies. In the IEA sustainable development scenario, non-OECD economies, particularly China, India, and the Middle East, are expected to see a significant increase in CCUS deployment, especially after 2030. But there are no signs yet that this is materializing. Having said that, the outlook for CCUS project is improving. The same IEA report I mentioned before notes there at least 40 commercial projects that have been announced recently, with multi-billion worth of projects nearing a final investment decisions. But despite this, the scale of CCS deployment, even with these new projects, remain very small. It's estimated with the ongoing projects, storage would increase to about 220 million tons CO2 per year, which is still very well below the target needed in the IEA sustainable development scenario.
So what barriers, therefore, is CCUS facing in attracting more investment?
CCUS projects involve high upfront and operation costs, while they don't generate sufficient revenue streams, like, for instance, in the case for renewable electricity generation. Some revenue streams could be generated, for instance, by utilizing CO2 enhanced oil recovery and utilizing carbon in some industrial applications. But this opportunity has remained limited for now. So the only reason you would invest in a CCUS project is to address climate change. Also, CCUS has not been commercialized yet, and private investors are not willing to accept the financial and technical risks associated with investment in CCUS. Business models are emerging to spread the cost by splitting the CCS value chain into different components, capture, transport, and storing, which allow different market actors with different risk appetite to collaborate. But even with such a splitting, the risks remain high. And that is why public policies that aim at de-risking investments are required to promote the adoption and deployment of CCUS at scale. Most of the CCS projects being implemented have received government support in the form of direct capital injection or tax credits. But I have to say, David, that until recently, government support has been limited and inconsistent in most countries. After all, technologies such as CCS need commitment and stable policy support from the stage of demonstration to maturity to reduce the cost through learning and scaling up. Also, I would say the signals provided by carbon pricing mechanisms have not been sufficient to induce investment in geological storage. So that's additional layers of financial resources are needed to support investment. And I don't think policies have been put in place that value the contribution of CCS as a key mitigation technology.
Yeah, I have to say, Bassam, I agree with you just seeing what's going on in the world at the moment. But in the paper, you also discuss supply-side policies. You know, what are these policies? Can you share those with our listeners?
There are some who argue that carbon pricing in the form of taxes and emission trading systems by themselves cannot induce the change at the scale and the speed needed to achieve the Paris Agreement targets. So some have been calling to develop policies, complementary policies, including those that focus on the supply side of the equation. Some of these supply side policies focus on things like restricting the use of fossil fuels. Some even call for keeping reserves underground or making investment in hydrocarbons more difficult, for instance, through limiting access or increasing the cost of finance for hydrocarbon projects. Now, these proposed policies will amplify the distributional impacts we have discussed before, making hydrocarbon exporters worse off. Also, such policies do not provide an incentive for oil and gas exporters to play a more constructive role in climate change negotiations and would reduce their incentive to be part of the solution. They could also result in dislocation due to underinvestment and increase the cost of essential fuels by limiting supplies, making the transition more costly. Surprisingly, technologies such as CCUS do not feature heavily in these supply-side policies. Many remain skeptical about the role of CCUS as an effective climate mitigation technology, citing factors such as its high cost. Others cite fears around the safety and permanence of storage, though the risk of leakage of CO2 from well-designed storage is very low. Skeptics also argue that CCUS can perpetuate the use of fossil fuels and discourage countries from pursuing renewables. Sometimes they could also discourage, it's also argued that they could discourage change in societal behavior and it can reinforce existing dependencies and power structures. And sometimes it feels that some would like to address multiple issues, some of which are not related to climate. And I think this is not helpful. The focus should be on how to address the climate change challenge. And if CCUS is a technology that helps us achieve this goal, then it should be pursued and encouraged.
So if this is an essential technology, shouldn't oil and gas exporters be leading its development?
Yes, I think so. Not leading on the CCUS front could risk undermining their competitive position. In the paper, we argue that it's of strategic importance for large oil and gas reserve holders, either individually or as a group, to implement more projects to prove CCUS technology at scale, reduce its cost, and develop sustainable business models. Now, it's true that due to higher capital and operational costs, the returns would be lower compared to a strategy of exporting unabated gas and oil, and this strategy comes at a cost for governments. But this cost should be considered as investment that could increase the competitiveness of a key sector in a world transitioning to net zero. CCUS can support current industrialization strategy into energy-intensive industries. Also, this cost could be lower than those linked with diversifying into new non-energy sector. And these costs are expected to reduce over time. Also, David, the cost of not acting could also prove to be much higher. Having said all of that, if the cost of the CCUS project is too high, and if the cost is shifted to producers alone, this will reduce the incentive to undertake investment in these projects. All the stakeholders along the oil and gas supply chain will benefit from CCUS, and therefore the cost of CCUS deployment should be shared if CCUS is to emerge as a key mitigation strategy. Oil and gas exporters should leverage existing multilateral agreements and be proactive in climate change negotiations to try to put in place policies and mechanisms that generate revenues for deploying CCUS.
So building on that, question, Bassam. You know, why don't the current multilateral schemes encourage CCUS at a large scale?
CO2 emissions involve costs, or more specifically, negative externalities that are not fully internalized and not fully paid by the parties to the transaction. Implementing carbon pricing such as ETS or carbon tax is considered by economists as one of the most effective ways to internalize this cost and also incentivize investment in reducing emissions. This is based on the principle that the user of the fossil fuel or the emitter should bear the cost of the externality. However, this is not enough. Additional layers of finance are also needed. A good example is renewables, where governments provided feed-in tariffs and renewable portfolio standards to increase the share of renewables in the power mix, even when emission trading systems were in place. For CCS, this is needed more because, as mentioned before, revenue streams from CCS are limited, and one will almost only deploy CCS for climate change action. My co-authors Paul Zachgur and Wolf Heidegg have emphasized this point in their previous work, arguing for policies that offer incentive both for emitters and storers. And this could prove to be more effective in commercializing CCUS projects. That's why they emphasize the importance of having a well-defined policy frameworks to specifically support CO2 storage. Storing CO2 in the geosphere has a value, which is separate from emissions reductions, and this should be rewarded.
But have there been any practical policies proposed, Bassam?
Yes, and we discussed some of these in the paper and in a follow-up paper, which should come out soon. Some, for instance, have proposed the creation of zero-emission credits. My co-authors have proposed a carbon storage unit. This involves rewarding the activity of capturing and storing a ton of CO2. In effect, this creates an additional layer of finance, which can complement existing carbon pricing instruments. The CSUs can also offer a way to measure, monitor, verify the addition of 1 ton of CO2 to carbon sinks. Such instruments can be even traded or surrendered against government's obligation or commitments. And this opens options for producers, allowing them to play a more active role in climate change. For instance, a producer who wants to achieve net zero emissions but wishes to continue to extract certain amount of oil and gas can generate enough credits to offset the emissions involved in the extractions of these resources. Using these instruments, producers can also credibly demonstrate the extent to which they have succeeded in reducing emissions from their oil and gas activities.
Now, can these instruments be integrated into multilateral agreements such as the Paris Agreement, Bassam?
Yes, it could be with some effort. Article 6 of the Paris Agreement recognizes that some countries may have an interest in pursuing voluntary cooperation in implementing their nationally determined contributions, and CCS can play a key role in meeting these objectives. Granted, David, that not every country will be interested in CCS, but the elements of Article 6 allow for the creation of funds or CCA clubs of like-minded governments to enable CCS projects. For instance, some have proposed the establishment of development funds from like-minded investors or countries who are interested in the development of CCUS technology, maybe because they have common interest in lengthening the life of oil and gas. These countries could act as buyers to drive early demand for storage credits and to ensure price signals are generated. And as the market matures and a robust system of reporting, monitoring, and verification is put in place, these credits could be used to meet compliance and would count towards countries' targets and commitments, or they can even be traded as well.
Now, do such schemes, therefore, encourage burden sharing?
Yes, under cooperative frameworks. For instance, part of the storage unit generated could be sold to end consumers or importers using these fuels. And this could be done through bilateral agreements or clubs, as we just discussed. Oil and gas exporting countries should be exploring and pushing for such initiatives.
But how would one reconcile burden-sharing mechanisms with some countries or regions that are exploring the introduction of carbon border adjustment measures, CBAM, Bassam?
As mentioned before, David, applying carbon taxes to imports from oil and gas exporting countries has the effect of extracting big part of the rent from these economies. Rents that could be used to diversify their economies and invest in technologies that reduce their CO2 emissions. Also, some countries or regions may decide to use trade policies to induce a change in behavior in other countries. For instance, some countries could apply an extreme variant of CBAM and apply carbon taxes on imports from non-cooperative countries, irrespective of the carbon content of their export. This gives importing countries some leverage, but such a tax will act as a very blunt instrument and highly discriminatory, and like CBAM, may be resisted and subject to legal challenges under the WTO. But more importantly, I think it also undermines key principles, such as just and inclusive transition and the current multilateral framework, which is based on cooperation.
Now, Bassam, I always like to end up a podcast interview with what I call a forward-looking question. So may I ask you, are you optimistic that we will see CCUS becoming a key mitigation strategy and that oil and gas exporters will play a key role in that?
In a way, yes. But the frameworks need to change. CCUS has mostly been approached from a project developer's perspective, such as an international oil or gas company's perspective, and usually putting in place frameworks that spread risks and costs and enable the deployment of CCUS in a specific geographical context. For oil and gas producers, the perspective is much wider. For them, CCUS relates to the future of oil and gas and the key role these sectors play in their economies and welfare, and also it shapes their political economies. It relates to maintaining and establishing key sources of competitive advantage. So oil and gas exporters should take a leading role in scaling up CCUS and geological storage. But to enable investment in CCUS and minimize the adverse impacts on their economies and public finances, oil and gas exporters should also take a leading role in developing burden sharing mechanisms that generates new source of revenues for CCUS projects. And this could be developed within existing frameworks such as the Paris Agreement. And I believe this is needed in times when some of the current proposals and trade policies are being considered, and such policies could have the impact of making oil and gas exporters worse off and extracting large proportion of the rents at times when their economies need to undergo some massive transformations. To avoid such outcomes, I think it's very important to develop cooperative frameworks. But David, this requires harmonization of policies, strong cooperation, either through multilateral or bilateral agreements, or the creations of clubs of like-minded countries. Such cooperative frameworks, I believe, are key to deploying CCUS at a large scale and enabling oil and gas exporters in their path towards low-emission strategies. And I really do hope that spirit of cooperation prevails, as this could ensure a more inclusive, a more just and less costly and faster energy transition where all players could play an active role in climate change.
Which certainly is what we all want to see. Well, look, Bassam, thank you very much for your time today. As always, it's been great to talk with you, and I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on your recent energy insight, transitioning to net zero, CCUS, and the role of oil and gas producing countries. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.